This episode is brought to you in part by the Acceleron BioAg brand. Harness powerful crop solutions using technology derived from nature. Products from the Acceleron BioAg brand are bioenhancers, primarily containing live microbial organisms. The products help promote increased nutrient and water availability for better yield potential. Acceleron BioAg product offerings are available for canola, wheat, corn, soybean, pulses, and more. Visit AcceleronBioAg.ca for product information and to view BioAdvantage trial results from growers like you. Nature, it's powerful technology. Always read and follow label directions. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, we interview Ian Affleck of CropLife Canada about a European Union court decision that may pose challenges to gene editing in that market.
It's not a scientific policy decision that's been made by the European regulator.
Dan Orchard of the Canola Council of Canada discusses what's happening at the 2018 International Club Root Workshop. And Dave Sims of Commodity News Service Canada unravels what's new in the markets.
Corn definitely has some challenges.
That's all on Between the Rows with this week's host, Robert Arneson.
Hi, I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer, and welcome to another edition of Between the Rows. First up on today's show, gene editing is the hottest technology in plant science right now. That's because biologists can use it to precisely delete a gene or add a gene to a plant's DNA. Crop science companies have argued that gene editing is a modern form of conventional plant breeding. Therefore, the technology should not be regulated. But in late July, Europe's highest court ruled that gene-edited crops should be regulated just like GMO crops. Here to talk about the court decision and what it means for agriculture is Ian Affleck, Vice President of Plant Biotechnology for CropLife Canada, which represents the crop science industry. Ian joins us from Ottawa. Hi, Ian.
Hi, and thanks for having us on today. We really appreciate the invite.
Oh, great. Well, thanks for coming on Between the Rows. So I guess we'll start with kind of a basic question here. Can you just tell us what the European Court said in its ruling? Why did it just come to this decision?
Yeah, and I think the way you opened it in the segment is quite accurate. It's a legal decision by a top court in Europe that when you look into the wording of the current regulations, that they apply to any mutagenic-related plant breeding approach. So that includes gene editing. That includes a lot of things that haven't been subject to regulation in the past. And I think what's important to kind of clarify there is that point that it's a legal decision at this point. It's a legal interpretation. It's not a scientific policy decision that's been made by the European regulator. This sends a strong signal, but it isn't the final decision of how they will regulate the product, regulate gene editing just yet. But their decision was that the current regulations cover mutagenesis, which includes gene editing. It then decides that conventional mutagenesis, and I'm using my air quotes as I say that, because that's a fuzzy term in and of itself, remains exempt, which it's been exempt since the EU put its regulations in place, but then also gives flexibilities for the member states to make some of their own rules in that space. So all in all, it sends a direct signal that gene editing should be under some type of regulation based on the current regs, but it leaves a lot of ambiguity and a lot of confusion for anyone who's trying to sort through this, especially someone who's looking to invest in plant breeding innovations going forward.
So the reaction from crop science companies was quite strong. I mean, you know, there were some suggestions that, okay, well, there's kind of pointless investing in Europe anymore. We need to move out of here and go other locations. I mean, the plant science industry was not happy with this decision, correct?
Yeah, I think disappointment would be the I think the nicest word to use. I think we were hoping that this was an opportunity for Europe to take a more rational approach to regulation of technology going forward. Their GMO, quote, you know, air quotes again, regulations that have been very process-based over the last number of years has created a lot of challenges globally, and we were hoping that this was a chance to rationalize that. We've learned a lot in the last 20 years. I think Europe has as well. They're a major importer of biotech products from around the world, and we really thought here was an opportunity for them to get it right going forward. It kind of falls into that position of this is another example of where Europe is unfortunately handcuffing their own farmers. They're the ones that aren't going to get their hands on the new and positive technologies that could help their farming situation and limit their ability to produce more agricultural goods going forward. I just had a couple of stats written down here. Europe imports about 34 million tons of soybeans per year, which is about 60 kilograms per EU citizen. And in 2014, they only produced 1.7 tons of soybeans themselves, which is less than 5% of their need. They could go a long way to bolstering their own agricultural sector if they took a more rational approach to regulation.
So just for the sake of an example, I mean, as you said in the beginning, we don't know exactly what this court decision means yet because it's not policy. But let's just, for the sake of an example, just say, like, if a company uses gene editing to come up with, say, a new variety of wheat, and that wheat has a higher protein content, under this ruling or this decision, that variety would be treated or regulated like a GMO because it was created with gene editing, correct?
If you took this interpretation at its kind of strictest view, then that would most likely be correct.
Okay.
But I think that's what's really important to see going forward is from what we're hearing is that we won't see a policy decision by the EU regulator until late in 2019. So we wouldn't expect anything to take place between now and then directly in terms of new regulations or new oversight coming into place. But it's with it between now and then, what their regulatory interpretation is of this legal decision is what's really going to give the answer to that question. And I think anything outside of that right now, I'd be just speculating as to how they might view it.
So I guess the issue here for crop science companies is that the regulatory costs associated with GMOs are extremely expensive. Can you just sort of give us a sense of, you know, the costs involved there for companies in your industry?
Yeah, and I can kind of, I'll try to tie it into the Canadian context as well. A recent study was done in support of some of the seed synergy work that's going on. I don't know if you've heard of that at this point, but it's some work in the seed sector toward kind of creating a more efficient seed management framework at large that includes seed certification, et cetera. But in that report, it talks about the general cost of going through the a biotech submission is between $500,000 and $4 million here in Canada. And we have, I would say, a more rational and a more reasonable approach than our European colleagues. So it would at least be that much, if not more, in Europe. And it takes, where in Canada we get it done in about 2 to 3 years, in Europe it can take 6 to 8 years to get an approval. So there's a lot of cost in just not getting your product on the marketplace as you wait for that export market to open up. So when you see all of those costs piled on to a technology where a lot of the excitement was that it was hopeful that regulators could understand that this is very akin to the conventional breeding that they haven't been regulating for many years, and that you would be able to provide these tools to a much broader swath of the breeding community. I think with the fact that these tools are cheaper to invest in, you can get the license for it from the universities that have developed it quite easily and allow a lot of different breeders to get involved. But once you add on these, you know, extra 6 years or whatever it may be and $500,000 to $4 million plus dollars worth of cost, that becomes a very different investment decision. And from that, you'll see, unfortunately, the loss of that money. There's going to be a cost to farmers. It's not just a cost to the innovator, but the farmer then waits longer for the new technology, which is unfortunate. And we may see some innovations not make it to market. And then there's also downstream costs to the consumer, because if the farmer can't be as efficient as they can be, farming is environmentally sound as the technology will allow them to, and they also may miss out on some of the culinary traits that we're seeing now, whether it be things like the Arctic apple and the Simplot potato. Those aren't gene editing, but there's more opportunity for those really interesting to the consumer type benefits as well, that we may see an opportunity lost in that space as well.
So I guess that was sort of my next question, is that, you know, what does this all mean for Canada's ag industry? Does that mean like somebody might not go down the path of using gene editing to create a certain crop trait because the market might be partially in Europe? And therefore you say, well, we can't sell this into Europe, therefore we're not going to use this technology. Is that a potential consequence here?
I think that's a potential consequence, but I think we're, as we mentioned earlier, that you're looking at probably late 2019 before there's an EU regulatory decision on whether or not they're going to interpret their regs the same way as the legal decision. I think there's an opportunity there. There's an opportunity where we see a number of countries that are making much more rational decisions about how they're going to approach these plant breeding innovations. Canada is in the midst of working with industry on clarifying its regulatory approach and how it's going to handle these products going forward. So you're going to see, most likely, and we've already seen it in the press, that a significant amount of R&D is going to leave Europe, because this signals that that's not the place to invest in developing new products. So that could be a windfall for Canada if we can encourage that investment to come this way. And if the rational-minded countries around the world can come together on how to approach it and help Europe find a better way before 2019, then you can hope that we'll still see the innovation we have the excitement for in this sector, and that Europe will not be the stumbling block. And I think that the final loop around that would be, and even if they choose to handcuff their farmers, if they choose this unfortunate path, they're already doing that now with our current biotech products, and we're managing to continue to innovate in Canada, to continue to adopt the products and continue to export. So while Europe is its own jurisdiction, they can make their own rules. They do have to respect international trade rules and have functional regulatory systems, which we're working with them on. So I don't want to say it's all doom and gloom. This is a very disappointing and unfortunate decision, but you know, there is light at the end, and we can still move toward encouraging innovation in this sector.
So just so the sake of clarity, I guess what I'm interested in here is that, you know, it seems like, as you use the word path, and it seems like Europe is moving down one regulatory path when it comes to biotech and crop science, and a lot of the rest of the world is heading down a different path. You know, is that sustainable in the long run? Because, I mean, obviously Europe is a massive market. You know, we can't have one part of the world going in one direction and the rest going in a different. I mean, how do we resolve that long term?
Well, I think that's where our international trade rules kind of come into place. And we've seen this in the past where at one point in the early 2000s, Europe regulatory system was simply not functioning. It was on the books, but there was zero approvals coming out of their system. So it was functioning like a de facto moratorium. I believe it was Canada, the U.S., and Argentina took them to the WTO, and that kickstarted their approval system into actually approving products. And since then, we've been working with them, and our Canadian government folks at AFC and the Canadian Food Inspection Agency and Health Canada work with Europe multiple times a year to ensure that that system keeps moving forward. So it's not as quick as it should be, but it is functioning, albeit slowly, at this time. So I really think if the majority of the world is heading down the right path, then we have an opportunity to help point Europe down the right path, but also to have a balance of trade globally that Europe still has to participate in, even if they choose to make their own difficult decisions. And I think that's an important example there, is you hear a lot of press about how 19 countries in Europe have banned GMOs, which really isn't accurate. It's 19 of the European member states have chosen not to cultivate GMOs, but they all import them.
Okay.
So even though they make their own awkward regulatory decisions, they still have a requirement to participate in the global trade marketplace.
Okay. Thanks, Ian. I've been speaking with Ian Affleck of CropLife Canada about a European court decision to treat gene-edited crops the same as GMOs. I'm Robert Arneson of The Western Producer, and this is Between the Rows. Later on, we'll kick around the latest news from the commodity markets. But up next, plant pathologists from around the world are in Edmonton this week for the 2018 International Clubroot Workshop. The scientists are meeting to share knowledge and research about the soil-borne disease, which causes the premature death of canola plants and is a major threat to Canada's canola industry. Joining us to talk about the workshop and the latest news on clubroot is Dan Orchard, an agronomy specialist with the Canola Council of Canada in central Alberta. Dan joins us from Edmonton. Hi, Dan.
How are you doing today?
So you're at the conference, the workshop right now. Can you just talk about the workshop? What's the objective or purpose of this event that's happening in Edmonton right now?
Yeah, so the International Clubroot Workshop, it kind of gets hosted various places around the world, and we're fortunate enough to have our second time hosting it here. So the first time in 2013, and now this year. So the purpose of this is to kind of bring info from around the world and try to harmonize maybe some of the research and understand where the gaps in research are and some of the opportunities for researchers going forward. It's really just a bringing together of all the clubroot minds from around the world, and the presenters will present their findings on all their research and what they're doing going forward so that, we kind of work together internationally.
So how many representatives or how many countries would be represented there approximately?
Yeah, we're looking at about 15 different countries, and we're around 200 people, of which a little over 30% are from outside Canada. So it's nice for the Canadian attendees too to see some faces they haven't seen before and hear some talks from other people and what they're doing in other countries to kind of mitigate clubroot. So yeah, it's pretty exciting to meet all the people that you kind of read their papers or read about them in magazines and things, and then get to meet them in person.
Okay. So you're well aware of the story of clubroot in Canada, especially Alberta. So I guess it was discovered about 15 years ago in central Alberta. What's the state of the disease, you know, across Western Canada, in North Dakota, say, compared to 5 years ago? Where are we at?
I'd say in Alberta, we've progressed kind of on par with what we expect over the years, with around, 200 to 300 new fields each year. Kind of the radius of where the infection takes place moves by about 30 kilometers a year. And now reports from Saskatchewan and Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec, even out in the Maritimes, and of course, North Dakota, as you mentioned. So I think that it's two things, Robert. It's like awareness is out there. People are looking harder than they've looked before. So that's a really good thing. That probably makes it look like it's spreading faster than it has. It probably has already spread in the past, and we're just catching up to it now with looking for it.
Yep.
And also this year seemed to be the kind of year that clubroot really likes. Start out quite wet, nice moist soil, very warm, and then the tap turned off and everybody's kind of drying out. And so that's kind of a recipe for disaster. So I know there's been a lot of reports right across the prairies this year of plants already wilting and small patches appearing. So that kind of started earlier than we usually see. So mm-hmm. I guess I'm anticipating probably an above average year for finding clubroot.
So in my intro, I kind of described this disease as, a major concern for the canola industry. How would you characterize it? Is it the disease that is the biggest concern for your sector?
I'm a little biased because that's my focus, and I So I do think, though, that it's probably one of the major pests of canola. There's other insects and some other diseases as well that, you know, need to be forefront of everyone's mind, too. But the thing with clubroot is there's so many pathotypes that aren't controlled by our resistance. So we don't have a lot of control measures for some of these new strains that are appearing. Many of the other diseases and issues with canola have remedies already. So this is a little bit unique in that breeders and researchers are going to be busy for a long time to come, figuring out this disease and how to manage it properly. So I think it's probably up there, maybe even the top for potential threats to canola in the industry.
So I guess you kind of described that, you know, clubroot spreading in Alberta, and then it has moved to other provinces. Are there certain geographies that are the real hot spots right now, or areas that are of the kind of primary concern?
There are, and it's funny, you know, like years ago, a fellow named Kelly Turkington, who's kind of a friend of mine, and he works for Agriculture Canada, he put out a prediction model, I guess you'd call it. He took all sorts of factors and linked them together to make a map where clubroot would be kind of the hot spots, like you say. And that was made quite a while ago, and it's coming to fruition now, where the places he's picked tend to be the places that are now reporting clubroot, you know, many years after he predicted this. So I don't know if the map didn't get distributed well enough, or if these regions they're just so conducive for clubroot, being that they can hold moisture fairly well. So some clay in the soil and low pH is also a big factor. And of course, how much you grow canola is a factor too. So it's kind of northwestern Saskatchewan, I guess, you know, bordering Alberta, all of central Alberta, northern Alberta seem to be hot spots. And then there's a fair number of hot spots across Manitoba as well. And likely, you know, they have more heat, more moisture. So their soils would be a little more conducive.
Okay. So getting back to what you said a couple minutes ago about resistance. So obviously, as you well know, there are canola varieties that can resist this disease. There have been reports recently of that resistance sort of breaking down as the disease evolves and, you know, new strains emerge or new forms of clubroot emerge. How worrying is that for you? Is that your major worry about that the disease will evolve faster than plant breeders and biotech scientists can keep up with it?
Yeah, certainly. It's such a long process to come up with a new variety, you know, maybe 7 or 10 years to get it to market. And the problem now with all these new pathotypes is which one do you pick to breed for, right? There's just so many. So there's a few that are really predominant that are appearing, you know, a lot more frequently. So breeders are kind of picking those, which is understandable. But like I say, it's not that easy. So right now, the big concern in Alberta is to not let these new pathotypes spread. And where they are appearing are places where the kind of the old strain, let's say, built up to really, really, really high levels.
Okay.
And then they didn't rotate long enough out of canola to drop those levels. So the pressure is put on the resistant varieties and they end up being overcome by these new pathotypes. So Alberta is focused on not letting these pathotypes spread, whereas Saskatchewan and Manitoba need to back up a step and focus on not letting that original pathotype build up to very high levels.
Okay.
So using resistance and rotation and things like that are far more key, you know, in places that haven't been introduced to clubroot yet.
Okay. Last question, then I'll let you get back to the workshop. So how would you describe, like, the prevailing attitude out there towards clubroot? Are growers worried about the disease? Are they complacent? What's your feeling when you talk to producers about this?
It's funny how it changes across the provinces. Like, vary significantly. So we had canola palooza and cropsa palooza and, you know, things across the three provinces. And working at the club root station in each province, the questions were like uniquely different. So in Alberta, they're really concerned about how do I manage this when it's on my farm, because, you know, a majority of people are in an area with club root or they have club root.
Right.
Whereas Saskatchewan wants to know how, what can I do to not, you know, not end up with the problem that Alberta had? How can I prevent this kind of from getting to my farm and getting to that point? And Manitoba is kind of the same way as Saskatchewan is. They're really looking for ways to make sure that this doesn't become a problem on their farm. And they seem to be fairly well educated that they know it can spread in so many ways that it could be out of their control, but whatever's in their control, they're going to do. So it's encouraging. This is probably the biggest year that I've noticed concern. Like you say, no more complacency. It's time to nip this in the bud, really. For years, growers have kind of hidden this when they get club root. Mm-hmm. They're not sure what to do and don't really want to come forward about it. And that's changing as well. Even in Saskatchewan, they're starting to phone for help because they're prepared to do whatever the experts suggest they do in order to manage the disease instead of trying it on their own.
Okay.
So yeah, attitudes have changed, and that's quite encouraging.
All right. Well, thanks, Dan. I've been speaking about club root with Dan Orchard, a Canola Council of Canada agronomist in Alberta. This is Between the Rows. I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer. July was not a boring month in the world of agriculture. Donald Trump is fighting a trade war with most of the planet, and last month the USDA announced a $12 billion aid package for American farmers. Here to interpret the chaos and the implications for Canadian farmers is Dave Sims, a reporter with Commodity News Service Canada. Dave joins us from Winnipeg. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Robert.
Thanks for coming on Between the Rows. I appreciate it. So, as you are well aware, it has not been a normal summer in the ag commodity markets. What has all the chaos meant for canola prices this summer?
Well, canola has definitely had a choppy summer, to be sure. And, I mean, as you mentioned, yeah, the emergency bailout package for soybean farmers and other farmers, too, in the U.S. is going to, you know, put some distortion in the market. It's that package is going to give soybean farmers enough motivation to keep planting soybeans in the U.S., and that is going to weigh down canola, you know, even more than it is. Right now, definitely the weather premium is being felt. We're supposed to be pretty hot this week in Saskatchewan, Alberta. It doesn't look like we're going to see much rain, so farmers are, they've definitely got to be wondering a bit about yields, what they're going to be. Like, I think the majority of the crop looks fine, but yields are going to be the question. Fortunately, I know next week's better. We were going to get some temperatures maybe a little below normal from the 14th to the 21st. On the technicals, well, recent strength in the Canadian dollar is becoming a factor. Like, it's starting to want to climb above that 77 U.S. cent mark. And some buyers are just kind of waiting now for new canola crop to come online when they know the market's going to be cheaper. And, you know, from a technical standpoint, like canola, it seems to kind of want to chop between the 485 to 500 mark. And, you know, the funds are still short in the market. But, like, if we manage to actually hold above $500 a ton, that really seems to be the sticking point for canola. But if we could do that, then, you know, some of the funds may come in as buyers. And on Friday this week, the USDA is going to release its monthly supply and demand estimates, and that'll go a long way to determining where canola will go from here. Like, there's already ideas that the soybean count, the production estimate for U.S. soybeans is going to go up. And like that will definitely put some pressure on canola. But, you know, if the USDA will surprise us, like if that count is just up a little bit, well then, you know, canola may climb. But, yeah, no, I think staying above $500 right now for canola is kind of a hurdle for it. So, you know, but if we could do that for a length of time, I think we could get some momentum and go a bit higher.
Okay. So just shifting to a different part of the world. So there was some big news out of Ukraine in early August, I think on August 2nd, that some rumors of, you know, introducing export restrictions on grain. What can you tell us about that, and what does that mean for the global wheat market?
Well, that definitely turned heads throughout pretty much all of agriculture. Like when that rumor came out, well, actually it was a report that Ukraine was going to stop exporting wheat or put limits in place, and that sent the prices spiking. The Chicago wheat was at one point around July it was around $4.75, but you know when that rumor hit, like we were over $5, but the Chicago wheat nearly hit $6. So that's how serious that news was. Like, it just skyrocketed. And, you know, the hard red spring wheat out of Chicago, or out of Minneapolis, rather, and Kansas City, those two, they also spiked. So that definitely created some fears about supply. And then the focus shifted over to Russia. Mm-hmm. But Russia quickly came out and they said, look, we are going to keep exporting. So that things calmed down the next day because Ukraine kind of backpedaled a bit. And, you know, they said, well, it's just a rumor. And that, but that definitely had some repercussions. So, but I mean, the heat wave that they're feeling is real, like, and Europe's feeling it too. So, the yields for them, it's, you know, getting pretty serious too. And Russian wheat export prices continue to rise too, which everyone's watching.
So this is all a concern about to sort of adverse weather, too hot for wheat production, and therefore sort of yields and production will be down in those in that region of the world, and therefore fewer exports. That's the logic here.
Well, yeah, it's the uncertainty too, because I mean, Ukraine, they don't want to export too much. Like they don't want to get into a shortage. So, I mean, everyone's kind of hedging their bets right now. Except, I mean, Russia's got enough; they can keep exporting. But now Ukraine, they're kind of in a quandary right now too with prices. They're not totally sure what to do. So, I think that is definitely weighing on traders' minds these days.
Okay. So just shifting gears here to talk about corn and corn futures, is this having an impact on corn, or has corn been fairly quiet this summer? What's going on there?
Well, corn's been a lot more stable than wheat, although corn definitely moves back and forth with wheat. Like, the spillover action from wheat to corn is, like, there's a pretty firm link there. So when wheat goes up, like, corn will follow. But, you know, corn seems to be a little bit more stable. Like, it tends to want to chop around the 370 to 390 range right now. It's going to take a while for corn to get back up to that magical $4 a bushel for December contract prices. A lot of farmers in the U.S. seem to be hanging onto their corn right now, too, hoping the prices get stronger. And demand for ethanol is expected to move upwards, which should help. So the condition of the corn crop is pretty good, despite some bad weather at times, but the yields are, as with wheat, still a bit of a guessing game in the U.S. Okay. Recent tour around Bloomington, Illinois, I was reading, their yields that tour were just 145 bushels an acre, which is low for Illinois. But, I mean, and there's also some ideas that demand for U.S. livestock feed is going to go way down due to the trouble between China and the U.S. So, corn definitely has some challenges, but it seems to be a little more stable than wheat.
Okay. Is there anything else you're watching for this week in the commodity markets?
The only other thing I might be watching, this is closer to home, is volumes in canola. I'm not sure how widespread the knowledge of this was, but like canola, the trading floor recently switched out of Winnipeg and went down to New York, and that happened last week. And during the switch, some trading sites had trouble with the switch. Like, a lot of the trading is done through computers and algorithms and that. So there's some ideas in talking to the traders, maybe like not all the sites were in sync with the new system, which probably explains why the volumes were so anemic last week. I've never seen them that low. But they're a little higher today. So the sites, people have started to key in the right codes and everything, and we're starting to get back into regular volumes.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave. I've been speaking with Dave Sims, a reporter with Commodity News Service Canada. That's it for this edition of Between the Rows. I'm Robert Arneson of The Western Producer. Thanks for listening.
Today's program was brought to you in part by the Acceleron BioAg brand. Acceleron BioAg products harness the powerful technology of nature to release soil-bound nutrients, helping promote nutrient availability at the plant root. Accelerate crop performance with powerful bioenhancers aimed at promoting nutrient and water uptake and improved yield potential. Nature, it's powerful technology. Always read and follow label directions. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.